Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time listening to the Guelph Politicast, welcome. Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or are just making life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes. Today I talked to Bill Hewlett. If you know that name, then you probably read about or discuss Guelph issues online, because his name usually turns up in those conversations about the latest topical issues in the Royal City. A long-term political provocateur, Hewlett has now stepped his toes into creating his own journalistic endeavor called the Guelph Backgrounder, which aims to better inform readers by giving the latest issues a greater historical context. Bill Hewlett and being the long-term memory of the news is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast, but first, my usual public service announcement. Guelph Politico is crowdfunded through Patreon, where you can contribute on a per-monthly basis of any amount you feel comfortable using PayPal or your credit card, and all that money goes to maintaining a locally sourced independent media outlet in Guelph called Guelph Politico. Through your generous donations, you'll be paying to keep the Politicast going, as well as regular coverage of city council and politics in and around and concerning the Royal City. For more details, click on the giant orange P on the right-hand side of the Guelph Politico page, or go to patreon.com/GuelphPolitico. And now on with the show. When the Guelph Mercury closed earlier this year, the city not only lost a daily outlet for breaking news, but the institutional memory of an organization whose insights and reporting dated back to the earliest days of the Royal City. News doesn't happen in a vacuum, and it's only useful in the context of what has come before and where it might lead afterward, and at least one Guelphite has heard the call to fill the void on the former. Bill Hewlett should be a familiar name and a familiar face to Guelph politicos. He's run for council locally, he's helped build the provincial Green Party, he fought the good fight on a number of issues, including sustainability, the environment, and safe housing conditions, and now when he's not working at the University of Guelph Library, he's using its resources and the resources of the Guelph Public Library to look at how Guelph's history is informing news in the present, and he's posting his work on a new website called the Guelph Backgrounder. When I heard about Hewlett's site, I invited him to take part in this entry of the Politicast for a couple of reasons. One, it's a good way to address the lingering concerns over this past year, the first without a daily newspaper here in Guelph, and it allowed me to talk about the important need that Hewlett is filling. Context. How did the issues of today become the issues of today, and where might we be going next? Guelph is very interested in its own history, and the kind of long-form journalism Hewlett's doing is both necessary and tough to do with any regularity. It's a very involved and time-consuming responsibility, but one that is more necessary than ever. So I invited Bill Hewlett into the studio a few weeks ago to talk about the Guelph Backgrounder. So Bill Hewlett, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
To start off with, I think a lot of people might recognize you, if only because your name. You post a lot on, I mean, in the glory days of the Mercury, your name was frequently in the comments section. But for people who may not be familiar with your background, you've been a longtime Guelph politico, haven't you? If I may borrow my term and cast it onto you.
Yeah, I've done a few things over the years.
You were in the Green. You were a Green Party once upon a time.
Yeah, I've run as a candidate. I ran the riding association, basically built it from scratch, 1988. My fingerprints are all over the Constitution of the Green Party of Ontario. I was communications chair for the Green Party of Canada for a while.
Wow.
So I've done a fair number of things like that. I've done other things. I had a weekly column in the Mercury for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I organized a slate of candidates that ran municipally and was quite successful getting people elected. That's where Karen Farbridge's career started.
Mm-hmm.
That
was in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. Organized bioregional congresses along the Grand River under their heritage designation. Sued Walmart, I guess, was the last big thing. Is I sued Walmart as part of a multi-faith group, and we got
right.
a pretty sizable out-of-court settlement and
mm-hmm.
and various agreements about site abatement to protect the St. Ignatius property.
The famous Walmart fight, yes. So you've been in the trenches, but now you are behind a blog and the Guelph Backgrounder, and I do like the idea of it, because I do think
in just covering the news day to day to day, we do miss the context of it. That issue is like, well, let's pick a recent one like the Guelph Municipal Holdings Inc. That just doesn't happen. It kind of seems like it happens because it kind of revs up and it bursts into a thing all of a sudden. But these things don't happen overnight. As there's no such thing as an overnight, you know, situation or success or issue or that kind of thing. So, what made you want to sort of put pen to virtual paper to try and get this information out there?
Well, I guess the Mercury folding,
mm-hmm.
and not having a pay. And frankly, I've never been terribly happy with the work the corporate media does because reporters run around and, you know, they have to put out fires all the time, and I'm more concerned about the long term. But I had this meeting over at the Breezy Breakfasts that Phil Ault and James Gordon organized, mm-hmm. and they were going on about the district energy system.
Right.
And I was kind of, there was a lot of upset about this in the community, and I was trying to figure out what was going on.
Right.
And I asked counselors and various people there, and I got a very distinct impression that none of them really had a good grasp of what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I wonder how many stories are there out there where, like, nobody's really had the time or inclination to really do the research and find out the details.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I know lots of people in the community that know a lot of things. Why don't I hit them up to write stories about this? You know, they've all got university education, so they know how to write an essay. Well, that was pretty ridiculous. You're laughing for very good reason. I may get a couple stories written by other people, but it very quickly turned into I'm going to have to do all the legwork and the writing. But on the other hand, I'm actually learning an awful lot about the world around me, and that's kind of exciting. I enjoy doing that sort of thing. And with the internet now, it's so much easier.
I am laughing, first of all, the presumption that even university grads know how to write an essay, but yeah, also finding people to do the legwork for you. It's something I discovered is, yeah, you have to eventually sort of suck it up and do the work yourself, for sure. I do find the idea interesting, how it ties into the Mercury as well, because newspapers aren't just sort of telling you what's going on today. There is that institutional knowledge. There's that 149 years of people reporting the news as it happens. But as I said, the news just doesn't sort of, it happens. It's a progressive series of events with new developments. So I think in a sense, perhaps what people haven't appreciated yet about losing the Mercury is not that we have lost a daily news source with the talent and the resources to chase new stories and not just what's happening now. But the archives were later donated, the Mercury archives were donated to the museum. But, I mean, there was a couple of weeks there. We didn't know what was going to happen to that, just that institutional knowledge.
Well, actually, that's a good point. And it's sad to say the Mercury was suffered a long, long, painful death before it closed its doors. When I started being involved in stuff, the Mercury had a lot of people working as reporters. They had dedicated photographers, yada, yada, yada. But there was a period of time, something like 10 years, when that newspaper changed hands,
mm-hmm.
bought out at least once a year. And every time,
that's true.
Every time a new person bought that newspaper, you'd go into the newsroom and there'd be a few less faces. And mm-hmm. at the end, when Torstar owned it, it was like increasingly the reporters were people who lived out of town and commuted, and they didn't know anything about, there was no institutional memory there at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still put out product, and if you don't have institutional memory, it's really not what it used to be.
Yeah, news doesn't just, not to belay the point, but it just doesn't happen on its own, but news is only useful in the context of the people who are affected by it and who have experienced it and who have previous knowledge of it and where issues started.
Yeah.
So in terms of starting your own blog, I mean, this is this is kind of no easy task, and it's kind of also a form of reporting that I think the internet has yet to... well, I don't think it's the internet so much that hasn't wrestled. I think people encountering it on the internet. I mean, long-form, research-based, typically internet reporting is about the quick hits, about, you know, 200 words on this, 300 words on that. So in terms of the format and the intent, I mean, are you concerned about managing to lure people in with all with these long-form explanations about issues that, you know, perhaps people aren't that familiar with and perhaps don't deal with every day, or, you know, are like maybe 10, 15, 20 years outside their area of experience in Guelph?
Well, it's certainly true. Now, I have a background. I've written a blog for almost 10 years on religious themes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Taoist. I'm a Taoist initiate, if anyone knows what that means, and I doubt very much anyone listening does.
You can't be sure.
But I've written long form, and I had a very, very good Google ranking for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I get busy doing other projects, and I don't write something for a long period of time. But if you look at my stats, I get a lot of hits on that thing. And it's because people hit it with Google. It's not regular subscribers. It's somebody doing a Google search.
Mm-hmm.
Because of my high Google ranking, people come in and look at it. So what that means is that I can build a readership if I stick with this long form,
mm-hmm,
of people looking for things. Now, the funding model is an issue. Because
yes.
money, if you're making your money off advertising, it's the clicks.
Mm-hmm.
The clicks that make it. And that's going to be an issue. But, I got a pretty good paying job. So I'm willing to just do it on spec and see if we can maybe educate people about the need of supporting things like this.
Absolutely. And I completely understand where you're coming from in terms of the funding models. Although I'm proud to say I do make more on Guelph Politico this year than I had last year. But I mean, just aside from the funding, I think the service is what's really valuable. And I wanted to talk about a specific example, particularly this time of year when you have budget and, you know, it's sort of where, I don't know, maybe campaign promises go to die in some cases. But you mentioned in a recent post the firewall between politicians and staff and how, you know, people get upset when candidates become office holders and the promises don't sort of live up to the campaign rhetoric. And how people learn the limitations of their office. And I found that, certainly I knew that. I've done interviews with counselors over the years, and I think it was an interview I did with Leanne Piper and Lise Bircher back in the last term, and they said, like, people think you're a city councilor and you can just do anything. And I do see the importance of that, reminding people that, you know what, you do not get mystical powers when you enter into office. And you know, you do enter into office with, you know, no matter how experienced you think you are, with a degree of ignorance about what the expectations are, what your capabilities are going to be.
And, you know, this is something I find over and over again. I had a few pints with a friend of mine about Donald Trump's election. And
a lot of people have been enjoying pints about Trump's election, but
yeah.
Yes, go on.
But he made the point that it seemed to him the people who had the most knowledge and the experience in politics were the ones that were least freaked out about this election.
Mm.
Because they understood that the power of any elected official is very, very limited.
Mm-hmm.
Even non-elected officials. There's a famous quote that's associated with Napoleon Bonaparte, I don't know who said it, saying that you can do a lot of things with bayonets, but you can't sit on them. You know, you have
very
to have a
true.
Certain amount of support from the populace,
yeah,
to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but I think this is something that has to swim upstream with a lot of people, and I think a lot of people who supported Trump are going to find this out the hard way, that he can't magically build a wall on the Mexico border. And I think a lot of people have trouble reconciling this in our own country. You know, Justin Trudeau, for example, got elected on, you know, pro-environmental green credentials. And of course, he has pretty much sanctioned the construction of one pipeline. It's likely other pipelines are going to get constructed. And it's not necessarily that he wants to build pipelines, but I mean, there's a whole process where the final decision isn't completely his, or isn't completely the Liberal government's. And I do wonder, maybe it's because of the fake news. We were just talking about fake news on open sources, about whether people truly understand the government or not, or at least understand that there's a whole machinery behind it that one person or two people can't change overnight.
Yeah, this is something that I find quite disconcerting. I even found this problem in the Green Party, of all places, is that there's a lot of people in society whose idea of democracy is, I get my own way all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And no, it's you get a say and you get to take part in the process. It's not you get your way all the time. And a lot of other people, the sets overlap, who basically see politics the same way you would in sort of, I don't know, a Germanic horde at the time of the Roman Empire. It's, you know, like, find a charismatic leader and follow them. Well, I'm sorry, guys, but that can lead to all sorts of problems.
Right.
So, you know, and we have all these checks and balances that came about, and I tried to point out in that blog post, using the example of Tammany Hall, that a lot of these rules that look silly aren't silly. They came about because they're dealing with a significant problem, you know. So, you know, it's the checks and balances and the firewall. Now, I will admit that there does seem to be a problem in Guelph that nobody really seems to know what's going on with the staff. And this firewall has become the great wall of City Hall that you can't find out what's going on behind it. But, you know, that's the new problem we got to figure out a workaround for as a society.
That's a great point. And something I've been dealing with this year is just, you know, how much kind of happens behind closed doors and closed meetings, and people all of a sudden are gone. And maybe it's because they got a new job in Halton or Mississauga or wherever. Or maybe it's because they were, you know, showing the door, to put it a nice way. And, And this is maybe where you can come, your blog can come into service, but it's frustrating though. It's because I'm sure there are these things are discussed in closed meetings for a reason. But I also feel like if I went to the CAO or the mayor and said, like, why is these things being talked about in a closed meeting? The answer is, I can't talk about it because it's a closed meeting.
Well, I mean, that could be for very good reasons, or it could be that's a very convenient thing to say.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. The part of the problem is our society is complex, and it's getting more and more complex every year as new problems arise. I mean, when I was young, when we had plastic on the farm and garbage, we put it in a pile, and we poured gasoline on top of it. My dad would roll a rubber tire that was lit on fire into the middle of this thing, and it would burn, and the smoke would roll all over the place. Well, you can't do that anymore, and for a very good reason. And that's why we have things like the wet-dry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to get together a bunch of guys who were involved in the process of why we have a wet-dry, which is a big historical complex reason to write a story about that. But that's just one thing, you know. But this drives some people berserk. What do you mean I have to sort my trash, you know, and
still
roll out these bins? And
and
that's just one thing. I mean, you start telling people, well, you have to, if you're going to live in the countryside, you got to pay a lot more for your electricity because of the lines are all falling apart because they've been ignored for so long. Or we need groovy new lines because of solar power and wind turbines. And it's like, well, I don't want to hear about that. I just want cheap electricity.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry. The world doesn't really operate that way.
It does seem like the complications you mentioned, things are more complicated now versus people being stuck in their ways. I love the wet-dry debates because some people are just still so mad about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost, it has to be more than 20 years since since that was enacted. But people still wish they could just shove it into a big black bag, put it out on their curb, and away it goes to somewhere that's not here. And that's in spite of the fact that nobody wanted a new dump built here.
Well, you know, that is such a bizarre situation because I was around at the time. And the fundamental problem, and off the record, various people will tell you this, but not on the record, the absolute best place to put a landfill is on Class A1 farmland.
Mm-hmm.
Nice clay base, flat. You put it in, the clay keeps it from leaching and blah, blah, blah. But people have this sentimental idea that, oh, no, we can't put garbage on farmland. Well, it's really not that much difference between putting garbage on it, paving it, and putting it in the subdivisions.
Yeah. I mean,
you're pulling it out of production either way.
Yeah.
And but this sentimental feeling that ended up being enshrined in law in the province made it really difficult to find good landfill sites. I'm not generally in favor of landfill sites, but there's a certain layer of absurdity there.
Right.
And to the point where the city was seriously considering building an incinerator, which would have been a catastrophe,
mm-hmm.
because the incinerator technology was awful then. We would have been spreading furans and dioxins all over southern Ontario. That would have been a crazy idea. So, I mean, you know, but the thing is, to this day, people can't say, experts can't say in public, oh, well, you should put it on landfills on Class A farmland, because they would get eaten alive for it.
Right.
And that gets back to why Justin Trudeau can't come out and say, we can't build these damn pipelines, climate change, because
right.
he'd get eaten alive for it.
Yeah. And yeah, and it seems like, and it wouldn't be just in places either where the pipelines will benefit, like Alberta, Saskatchewan. Like, there would be people in Ontario and Quebec, it would still be ticked at him about it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, and since you're kind of a fellow sort of news hound, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately as we get to the end of the year, but do you think people have a proper appreciation for what we've lost with the mercury not being there anymore? Do you think, and I'll just, from my point of view, I think one of the things that Guelph Today did, and leaving aside the work that Guelph Today does, which is, you know, they have good people working for them and good columnists, and, you know, they do a very journeyman job of covering the city. But I do think in the back of my mind what Guelph Today did, and maybe I'm speaking from just like a personal place, is that it kind of absolved the city about the price of news, having to pay for news. And maybe this gets back to our earlier point about funding models. But I do feel like, because the Mercury had, you know, less than 10,000 subscribers when it closed, I do wonder if maybe people just, that the immediate reaction of like, oh my God, it's closed, what are we going to do? And then the Guelph Today kind of coming in and doing most of what the Mercury did, including, you know, hiring several of the Mercury people, be they columnists or reporters. But I wonder if that made it okay. That we kind of went back to, we don't have to worry about the news. It's taking care of itself.
I think we're suffering from a frog in the pot. Because when I started getting interested in this stuff, I had a lot of friends. I even dated reporters that worked at the Mercury. I lived across from the Mercury for 14 years, like literally across the street. I knew a lot of these guys. I walked on their picket lines with them when they were on strike and stuff like that. Went and picketed outside Ken Thompson's house one time.
That's a ways back.
That's a ways back. I think people have, the decline of the Mercury went on for so long and was so severe that after a while, and I'm one of them, it's just sort of like, oh, the Mercury died? Oh, well. Because it, as far as I'm concerned, the quality of the news just was so gone by the time it folded formally that was it. You know, like, I didn't really miss much.
Yeah.
I guess that's an awful thing to say. It's better if somebody, you know, explodes in front of you than just sort of fades away. or maybe not somebody, but something explodes in front of you. It's more dramatic, and you're more, you miss it more than if it just slowly fades away. And I think that's what happened with the Mercury. It faded away. And there's this, we were talking about fake news. There's this simulation of news that exists out there. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to this awful show they have on the CBC called This Is That. And there's something about the whole concept of you just make crap up, and then that's called satire.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's kind of an insidious thing that's happening all through our society. And, you know, it happens with things like you have op-ed writers that don't do any research.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you look at Fox News in the States, and they just have a bunch of blowhards, you know. When I wrote my column, I actually did research.
Mm-hmm.
Pierre Burton, when he wrote for The Star a gazillion years ago, he not only did a lot of research, he had two researchers working for him doing research. And people have this idea that opinion, you just sit down and cruise the internet, and then you just write some stuff off the top of your head, and boom, dilla boom, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that kind of appalling.
It's a good way to look at it, because I think to go into the American point of view, a lot of people look at the Jon Stewart Daily Show and we're like, oh yeah, he's doing journalism while being funny. I'm not sure I would call it journalism as so much as like just doing the work of, you know, pointing out the hypocrisy and like having somebody who can go back and find video clips, and I'm not sure that counts as journalism. But on the other hand, I remember watching CNN like the day after the Daily Show, where he would like mock a particular CNN reporter, and that reporter would be on the air talking about how they were mocked by Jon Stewart the other night and loving it, like it was some sort of like, you know, prize, and completely missing the subtext. And it seems like people, you know, again, it's people learning the wrong lessons of that. That, yeah, you can be funny while making a serious point, but the point of the news isn't to be the Daily Show either. And I do blame, I think, to a certain extent, the mainstream media in the United States for abdicating a lot of responsibility to the Daily Show. Oh, the Daily Show's mocking that, so like we don't maybe have to do that so seriously. Maybe I'm taking that a bit too far, and that has nothing to do with what's going on in Guelph. But since the issue came up, it does. I do agree with your point that, you know, we sometimes want to mask legitimate criticism in quote unquote satire because we don't want to honk off the people in power.
Well, I mean, there's lots of issues too. I mean, access, you know, if you piss off everybody in town by being a curmudgeon, they just won't talk to you. I'm enough of a curmudgeon. I've seen that happen, you know? So that's, I mean, what are you going to do if you're a member of the press corps and the president will never ask you a question because you pissed him off about a story you wrote?
Sure.
Well, you're going to make everything soft as a result.
Yeah. It seems like, I don't know, it seems like everybody's kind of forgotten their responsibilities. And maybe it's always been this way, but, you know, people in power have to recognize that when you're in power, you know, you paint a target on your back, and people writing about the powerful have to realize if you're writing about the powerful, you yourself may be painting a target on your back.
Yeah, yeah. I think it really, a lot of this stuff just comes down to time and money.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of time to do background research. And if you're going to hire researchers, that takes it. And one thing I noticed with my friends who were professional reporters is that they got tired after a while. They just got sick of hopping in their car, running to talk, interview somebody, do a couple notes, pop in their car to the next story, and sit down. And every time somebody bought the Mercury for an inflated rate, they would lay off a few more reporters so that they could pop up the profits to pay off the junk bonds that bought the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, I knew a guy who worked for the Mercury for years, and he actually was quite successful. He was a municipal affairs reporter for the Montreal Gazette at one time. And he downsized, moved to the Guelph to lower the workload. And at the end, he literally was so pissed off with being a reporter that he said he'd rather deliver the newspaper than write for it. And he did. And he quit his job as a reporter, and he had a couple paper routes, and he was delivering it. And then he got a job working as a groundskeeper on one of the golf courses. And he was totally happy. He never regretted that at all. And I know so many people that went into reporting thinking it was a wonderful, interesting job, and by the end, they hated it.
Everybody thought they were going to be Woodward and Bernstein. What they didn't realize was that the movie Woodward and Bernstein weren't the real-life Woodward and Bernstein who, you know, still had to file stories while also pursuing Watergate, not knowing that, you know, real life doesn't always measure what you see in fiction.
Well, that's true, but there was a... When I started hanging around the newspapers peripherally... it was different. The workloads weren't so intense. You could do research. I used to sell stories to sell op-eds to newspapers. You used to be able to do that. I would sit down and hammer something out, email it off to the KW Record, and I'd get 10, 15, 20 bucks for something I hammered out.
Right.
That all dried up within 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And then then the workloads just got harder and harder, and it just started shaking loose everybody who wasn't like a speed freak,
right?
You know, or a masochist.
And no, and that's a great point, is that, you know, it became about the, it didn't become about the news. It seemed to become about the news cycle, and you had to crank out so many stories and in the same time period. And I do wonder about that, because, That's a hard business to be in, when you just have to sort of crank out content and keep cranking and cranking it. And for, I think for some journalists who come from a more deliberate pace, it might be more difficult to get their heads around that internet pace and the idea of the content mills, whether you, that's a negative connotation to you or not, but the idea where you have this website and you have to put up something every hour, or else you start losing clicks and you start losing hits, and then your ad revenue starts going down because it's all based on the amount of clicks you're getting, and that's a hard pace to keep.
Oh, I fully understand that. I've self-published a couple books, and I've been trying to do promotion on the magazine I started, the Guelph Backgrounder, and I hate marketing. I hate the business side of it. I just loathe it. I mean, I'm adept enough. I have the tools.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I can push something out and I can see the hits going up. I can see the, you know, the interest. I even see book sales going up. And then, oh gosh, what am I going to do now? I have to keep feeding the beast, or else everything just dries up eventually.
Yeah.
And it should be enough just to do the writing and the reporting and the research, but oh no, it's at least as much work going into the fundraising side of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the way it is now. Maybe it'll change in 10 years, hopefully.
Well, and I always point that out to people, that if there's a bright side to sort of what's going on in the media today, it's that I don't think there's a right answer. Nobody's discovered the silver bullet or the bullseye in terms of how you make this work now, and that there's for inventive people and for people with, you know, an entrepreneurial spirit, or just, you know, can just generally think of things in different ways, you know, it's almost a golden age, because there's no right answer. And if the person who does find the right answer will certainly have a place in journalistic history if they figure out a way that's to save the business and make it good at the same time.
Well, my feeling is that it's not a business; it's a vocation, and that when it was just a business, which what it was with the Mercury, it didn't serve the community very well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's going to have to be some sort of social support.
Mm-hmm.
Whether, you know, I've mentioned the idea when the Mercury left that the municipal government should pony up some money to keep some sort of news thing on the go. We do that with TV Ontario, we do that with CBC, we do that with CFRU, the Ontarian, the Peak, if it's still around. I guess the Peak's
I'm pretty sure it's still around.
Yeah. Those are all basically socialized news services.
Very true.
And but, you know, the thing is nobody thinks of them in that term. So they they just think I'm a flaming lunatic. So, but, you know, maybe maybe community groups will come forward and support news services. That's something I'm going to try to pursue. Why not see if you could get some of the unions to support Guelph Politico and the Guelph Backgrounder? I mean, basically, it serves a purpose that's really in their best interest for people to be informed.
Very true. Speaking of Guelph Backgrounder, what's your plans, immediate plans? What are you writing about now, and what do you hope to cover in the future?
Well, I've got three things I'm working on. I just got an email from a fellow at the public library. I want to do a background on the case for building a new library.
Oh, that's a good one.
Why do we need a library? Well, I'm going to find out if we do need one. And then I've got a bunch of guy who's rounding up a bunch of people who were there when the wet dry was started to build up the historical reason why we have a wet dry and why it came out the way it did. Because a lot of people, I don't think, have a clue about why we have this thing. They just think it's sort of descended from the clouds by a bunch of socialists for no reason at all. You know, it's and I also am interested in writing a story about the OMB.
Yeah.
Because the OMB is, I've had experiences, good and bad, with the OMB. And one time I can remember sitting in a meeting and having a judge from the OMB threatening to basically sue away my home and my life savings.
A judge.
Yeah, it was mediation with Walmart. Yeah, that's what happens in mediation, is threats and counter threats and stuff like that. So, you know, that's a very interesting thing. I just found out recently, for example, that the OMB was originally an outgrowth of a provincial committee that was set up to govern the growth of railways between cities.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the sort of thing that you get out of doing the effort, making the research. So I give people an idea of what's going on. And, you know, we don't have a city plan right now officially because there's so many.
Yeah, it's an appealed at the OMB for
exactly
almost 5 years now.
Yeah. And that's a big deal.
Yes, it is a very big deal. I did do a post in the summer about all the appeals, in Guelph related appeals currently before the OMB. So yeah, and one of them is the official plan. I think it might be surprising to people, you know, just in terms of what goes on. And again, I think this goes to the importance of what you're doing. What goes on when it's not in the news every day? There's still stuff going on, and I think people don't appreciate that. Just because something's not in the news doesn't necessarily mean that it's quiet on that particular issue or cause or case, whatever the situation may be. Anyway, I think we are way over time, but it was a great discussion, Bill, and good luck with the backgrounder, and I appreciate the work you're doing. Thank you so much for taking part today.
Well, thank you, and I certainly appreciate the work you're doing too.
Well, thank you. And once again, that was Bill Hewlett. You can find his new website at guelph-back-grounder.blogspot.ca. You can also get in touch with Hewlett at thecloudwalkingowl@gmail.com or on Twitter at cloudwalkingowl. Or you can find and like the Guelph Backgrounder page on Facebook. As for the Guelph Politicast, that's it for this week. The music for the podcast comes from KPN Classics and Sid Dale. The host of the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to previous episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you've missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And of course, you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. And for all the latest political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we'll have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.